Less than 10 seconds now. The confetti is going. The balloons are up. 6, 5, 4, 3. Happy 1998.
Wake up, kids. We got the dreamer's disease. Age 14, they got you down on your knees. Hello, and welcome back to Over and Back's NBA 20 Years Ago series. I am Jason. With me is Rich. Hey, Rich.
What's going on?
Oh, man, not too much. Just going to be enjoying a little bit more back into the look of the NBA in February and early March of 1998. Some interesting things going on as per usual. We got trade deadline. We have the All-Star game, and we've got some fascinating Denver Nuggets awfulness to talk about. So it's going to be fun.
I turned 11 at this time, a transformative 11. Yeah, you know, probably was just watching wrestling, I'm sure, and basketball.
Right.
And thankfully, I've changed a lot in the last, you know, now I'm 31 and I spend most of my time watching basketball and wrestling. So, but
sure,
you know, hey, I have a house now, so that's cool.
Yeah, you got a house. Yeah,
I have a house and bills, so I basically just added miserable parts to my life. But yeah, the other parts are still kind of the same. I haven't changed at all since I'm 11.
But you're smarter about those things than you were.
You're right.
When you were 11. So
yes, and I'm leveraging them into fun money making opportunities like this multi-million-dollar podcast that we do here. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're up there with Chapo in terms of the revenue we're producing. So yeah, you know, leftist podcasts and NBA history podcasts. That's the way
to
go.
Of course.
You know. Yeah. So. Yeah, so we're changing the format of this slightly. We've kind of dividing it up instead of going through the events as they occur. We're kind of hitting some topics, and then toward the end, it'll be a little bit more narrative. But we're going to try to organize a little bit differently. If people enjoy that or don't enjoy that, please let us know. You can always find us on Twitter at Over and Back NBA or at NBA 20 Years Ago. Either way, we will see it. And we appreciate any feedback that we get on this. So we're going to start off looking at four spotlight players, look at just guys who did something interesting or did particularly well during the month. This is just going to be the guys who did well in February, even though we're going to cover the events of early March, which we'll, you'll probably see why as we get through it. But the first guy we're going to look at is Tim Duncan, who in February averaged 25.7 points, 12.7 rebounds, 3.5 assists, and 3.2 blocks. The Spurs, after struggling a little bit early on in the season, they picked it up and are one of the better teams of the in the league at this time. We'll get into the specific record later on toward the end of the show. But he was Rookie of the Month again, as he has been in every month so far. Not really much of a contest there. One of the last guys, I forgot to look this up specifically, but he's one of the last guys to be an all-star as a rookie. Even LeBron didn't do that, so obviously notable accomplishment. That was less rare early on in NBA history, although still like only, you know, maybe a dozen or so guys have actually done it. But and one thing that I thought was really interesting was that when Sean Elliott went out, and this I believe was in January, the Spurs actually started 3 7 footers in on their front line. It was Will Perdue at center, David Robinson at power forward, and Tim Duncan at small forward.
Oh,
officially,
amazing! That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So. They had a lot of success with that lineup. They were in the first seven games after where they had that, they were 6-1. The trio averaged 52 points, 32.3 rebounds, 5.86 blocks. Probably Will Perdue not producing the most of that, but nevertheless, he did pretty well. And they were in mid-February, they were their opponents were shooting an NBA low 41%. And actually, that front line was called the Triple Towers, and they had won. They had a really good home record, 19-3. And then Tim, his first Player of the Week honor came in the first week of March. So he produced very well. You know, not a huge surprise. Of course, you know, we all know that he had a great rookie season and was immediately had impact there. But you know, had already performed well during the month, or during the season, but in February really came on and really, you know, was getting better as the season went along, unlike a lot of rookies who, you know, might start off well, but, you know, run into that rookie wall.
Right, and he's running away with this award as well. I mean, there's not really any. I mean, you have like Keith Van Horn, who's having an okay year. I know Zildjian Ogauskas in Cleveland's being, you know, he's fine, and
yeah, he's done well, but yeah,
Ron Mercer's okay, but it's like, dude, there's no question that Tim Duncan is the man. I mean, like he probably doesn't have a true case, but like there's like a groundswell of a potential MVP thing going on here. I mean, he's doing really well. I mean, it's incredible what he's doing. Of course, he's not going to win it, and there's obviously going to be much better contenders, but yeah, I mean, for him, runaway rookie of the year, and like, yeah, it was kind of cool to finally see him be the player of the month and rookie of the month. I mean, it's just incredible, and he's just dominated, you know, every single week and every single month of the year. And the cool thing is, yeah, you're starting to see the team emerge, and it's like, okay, here we go, we got something here. And it's not like the Spurs were bad for very long; they were bad for 1 year or whatever. But it, you know, seeing him fit in as well as he did, and it's pretty much a lot of what people expected out of Tim Duncan. But there was still the reservations of, okay, let's see if he can do it. And it was almost from day one, and we talked about it a few episodes ago in the series that almost from like day one. And game one, it was like, oh, okay, this guy can go. And he really never stopped, you know, that really, you know, that year or in any point of his career, because he retired is still being a pretty solid player as well. So it's going to be pretty fun about the Tim Duncan. But yeah, you can definitely see him just far and away running away with the Rookie of the Year award. I mean, you got Chauncey Billups and Tim Thomas and all these guys. But no, I mean, it's unquestioned that Tim Duncan's going to be your guy.
Yeah. And speaking as pretty solid late in their career, Karl Malone was NBA Player of the Month in February, 26.6 points, 10.8 rebounds, 4.0 assists. And he went through some notable milestones this year. He passed Oscar Robertson for sixth place on the NBA's all-time scoring list, also passed Adrian Dantley for fifth on the all-time free throws made list in NBA history. And actually, I think had a better month than even Jordan had. Jordan, we noted how much Jordan really carried the Bulls early on in that season and had some really huge scoring outbursts early on, you know, before Pippen came along and when Rodman was rounding into form and, you know, when the Bulls were struggling a little bit more without their depth. The Bulls definitely came on track in January and February and are leading the Eastern Conference. But Jordan himself, he's awesome. Still 25.5 points per game, 5.8 rebounds, 3.5 assists, and, you know, 47% shooting. But a little bit behind Malone, at least in this month. Overall in the MVP race, I would say Jordan probably still going to be ahead there. But they're, you know, definitely really the two candidates who I think anyone is taking seriously in that MVP race. And, you know, Malone, at least for a little bit, looking like he's at least ahead for the month. One funny thing that Malone talked about, it's more funny in retrospect, but we'll add it here. Greg Ostertag was injured for a while, and so Malone actually did play some center in games during the month. And then he actually quoted, he said, "I want to play with a dominant center before I retire." And then he said that he considers only three or four centers dominant, which makes it unlikely to hook up with one in Utah, which, of course, what would happen later in Carl's career. A little bit ironic there.
Yeah, going to LA, of course. But and you're looking at the MVP vote and the MVP race, really. I mean, we talked about some guys, you know, a few episodes ago, you know, a guy like Gary Payton had sort of made a little bit of some movement there. Shaquille had a pretty decent, you know, career or year going as well. But really at this point, like, it looks like it's Jordan. It looks like it's Malone as the two, and it's going to kind of be the battle between those two guys. And like you said, there's a justifiable case for Malone, definitely. I mean, Jordan is, to me, probably still the favorite. But yeah, it's not like if you said Karl Malone, I don't think that's a wild thing. But I don't know that anybody else could really make a super big case for even being in the discussion again. Like, you know, even we mentioned like a Tim Duncan, like he almost has an arguable case to be in the mix just because there's not really anybody else super emerging other than your Jordan and Malone. So those are definitely your two right now. But yeah, I guess there's, you know, your Peyton, your Shaquille O'Neal's, your, I guess, you know, like Tim Hardaway type is doing okay, but it's Jordan and Malone pretty much are your one and two.
Yeah, right. That's it. And a lot of the guys who are like normally dominant big men, you know, are falling off, including Hakeem Olajuwon, who was out for a couple months. I returned early in February. The Rockets were 14-18 without him. At age 35, only plays 47 games for the season. His he has 16.4 points per game, which is down from 23.2 the previous season, 9.2 rebounds, and a 5.31 true shooting percentage, all career lows. So he's, you know, showing signs of aging. It's there are no Rockets in the All-Star game for the first time since 1991, and Hakeem had been an All-Star every other season of his career, even as a rookie, one of the few to make that claim, of course, and actually would never be an All-Star again, although he was third-team All-NBA in 99. There was no All-Star game in 99, so he might have been an All-Star had there been one, but yeah, it's the end is definitely nearing for him. And the Rockets were 6-11 in January, which is their worst monthly record since 1990. In a positive note, he did become the eighth player in NBA history to play 1,000 or more games with the same team. The others at the time were John Havlicek with the Celtics, of course, Stockton and Malone, Hal Greer with the National 76ers franchise, Robert Parrish with the Celtics, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar with the Lakers, Dolph Schayes with the National 76ers, and Calvin Murphy with the Rockets. So a fun little club there. There have been a few players added to it since then. Kobe, of course, Paul Pierce, probably Tim Duncan. I'm sure there's a handful of others. But yeah, neat accomplishment there despite the downs of the season. And one more interesting thing on March 9th, it was the 7th, was the actual fight between Hakeem Olajuwon and Antonio McDyess of the Suns. They got into a little bit of a scuffle during the game. Some punches were thrown. They were ended up being suspended and fined for that altercation. A couple of Rockets players were also suspended for coming off the bench to aid in that situation. So Hakeem, you know, maybe he's not the player that he once was, but he's certainly the fighter that he
still knock you down, Antonio. But no, it's interesting. And again, like, he's 35, so it's like, you know, you should, and we sort of take for granted when we talk about, you know, legends and stars or whatever, and then playing into their, you know, late years or whatever. But like, you know, he's a 35-year-old big man. Like, he probably should be, but it's still sad nonetheless that it's kind of ending, and you could see it sort of that it's probably not going to get any better. Like, it's not like, you know, it was some temporary thing where all of a sudden, you know, he had just a down year, and he definitely looks a step slower. He appears to be getting older, and it's like, yeah, he's 35 years old. He should be getting a little older. And guy's been playing, you know, a lot of basketball for a lot of years or whatever. But still sad to see, you know, one of the legends as you kind of see him falling and kind of, you know, it's seeing sort of the end of the line for one of the NBA's greats here.
Yeah. So, and last but not least, Nick Anderson of the Orlando Magic. He was player of the week at the end of the month, averaging 30.8 points and 7 rebounds.
But Jason, there's no way. He missed those free throws, then he was done. Then he left the league. He couldn't do anything. It was just a mental case. He was done. That's the narrative,
absolutely.
Right?
Well,
he's gone. Yeah. Right. No, not on this show, goddamn. Yeah. We destroy narratives.
And it's kind of interesting because, yeah, I mean, like, he played within his career norms pretty well in, like, the year after because he obviously missed the 4 free throws in the 95 finals in game one. In 96, he played fine. 98, this season, he's playing pretty well, you know, a little bit above his career averages, but playing fine. And it's weird because in 97, he did play poorly. He had, like, 40% free throw rate, or percentage, rather, compared to almost 70% the year before, and his career average was around 65 or so. So yeah, he had one really weird outlier season in 97, but it wasn't like it was immediately after. It was like a year after, and then he went back in 98, and then, you know, he was battling some injuries as he was getting into his 30s. You know, obviously the decline that most guys have around that age. So it wasn't like he was ever, you know, really good after this year, but he was perfectly fine. I don't know what happened in 97 particularly that led to that decline. Maybe it was just more injuries, or maybe something weird happened. But yeah, and this was his third career player of the week award, his first since 93, and helped really the Magic maintain without Penny Hardaway, who he played a few more games, but was really limited, played very little in those games, and then it was completely out for the rest of the season. But yeah, the Magic had an 8-game winning streak in late February and March to get back into the playoff picture, and they were a team that did not have a whole lot of talent, and they lost Darryl Armstrong, who had, you know, kind of come on and been a good guard. They lost Mark Price, I believe, as well. They had actually bring Spud Webb back in from obscurity to help out, so they were battling injuries, battling depth, but, you know, Anderson was helping them really, you know, at least, you know, stay in the picture of the playoff race.
Yeah, no, Nick's doing well and keeping Orlando going. Yeah, his career path is just inexplicable. It's like, you know, people kind of assume that, you know, after the NBA finals in 95, that it was kind of like, oh, and then, you know, he could never shoot free throws, but he was fine. And then, like, two seasons later, then he wasn't fine. And then the next season later, he was fine. So I don't know what the hell happened with Nick Anderson. But yeah, like you said, there could have been some weird shoulder issue, some Markel Fultz-esque injury thing, oddness going on, but whatever. I mean, we came back, and we're seeing here player of the week and really keeping everything going and keeping, you know, the team and you know, really his career alive in some ways, because the prior year everyone's like, oh shit, this might be the end of Nick Anderson. No, I'm still good. And of course, we'd, you know, see in later years he would be, you know, bad a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, he would fall off, but it's, you know, like, understandable reasons that he fell off. Not, it wasn't just like immediately. Like,
yeah, well, he's like in his early 30s, and like guys don't. Yeah, you know, you do fall off after, you know, playing in the league for 15 years or whatever it was. So no, but it wasn't like, yeah, it wasn't like day one after the NBA Finals. He was just like, ah, oh, I'm a terrible player now. So that's always kind of funny, but to see that sort of narrative. But yeah, I mean, it's cool to see the Magic sort of staying above water without Penny, and obviously, of course, many years without Shaq or whatever. So you're kind of seeing a little bit of the team, and that's kind of one thing that Orlando was always able to weather a little bit. And that's kind of a weird franchise as well, and I think one of these days we'll probably do like a long form thing about them of you know, they always seem to be able to get, you know, the next guy was always sort of there. I mean, of course, until, you know, recent history or whatever, but you know, you have Shaq come in, then Penny comes in, Shaq leaves, you know, Penny's the guy for a little bit, Nick sort of holds the water for a little bit, and then Tracy McGrady obviously comes a few years after, and again, like, they weren't on the league team at any point, but you know, and then you have your few bad years, and then Dwight Howard's there, and then you have your uptick or whatever. And it wasn't really until recent history that they've been kind of like a bad or, you know, historically bad team, but until that point they were always a team that was okay, you know, other than a few little, you know, outlier years here and there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they've never had, until now, this is by far their longest sustained stretch of, you know, of being bad. You know, even they became a relatively good team quickly after the, you know, 2 or 3 years of being, you know, bad expansion team. So yeah, it is interesting how their history has played out that way.
But now they have like Alfred Payton. I mean, obviously he's not anymore.
Yeah, no, they traded him. Like, he's on the Suns now. So
he did not replace Dwight Howard, unfortunately.
No, he did not replace Dwight. It didn't work out so well. So someday I'm sure they'll get their man. You know, perhaps Jonathan Isaac. Maybe he'll be really good. I don't know. Yeah,
given how this year's going, I don't think so, Jason.
Yeah. Well, you know. Yes. So moving on to we're going to look at a few spotlight teams who were notable for whatever reason in during this period of time. And we start off with the Indiana Pacers. They were 8-5 over the month of February. Actually, had a better January, but they were at this point challenging the Bulls and Heat for top of the league. Even though they didn't really have, I mean, they obviously had Reggie Miller, but they didn't necessarily have like a you know, elite star who was, you know, really carrying them. You know, they were just a really well-balanced team. You know, they'd added Chris Mullin. You know, they had Dale Davis and Antonio Davis and Rick Smits and guys like that. Mark Jackson was their guard. So they had a lot of solid players. And Reggie certainly, you know, he's an all-time great to an extent, but not quite the same, you know, didn't quite have the same, like, he was more steady and going to carry you, you know, like in big situations, but he wasn't necessarily going to be like the, you know, the single guy who was going to like create everything for you and, you know, really put you over the top. But I think honestly, like the real star of the team was Larry Bird, who was, it was his first year as coach, got a lot of attention for the Pacers, who didn't necessarily always get, you know, attention, at least during the regular season. And this month there's some colorful things that he did and some accomplishments that he had. He talked to, this is the Indianapolis Star. He answered questions for an MTV crew, and afterward he said, "I don't like MTV. Our league is going MTV, and that's what's wrong with it." So, Larry being curmudgeonly there.
It's also like, very, what is it, 19 like 86? Like, our league is going MTV. Oh god damn. Yeah. I don't know if in 1998, but whatever. Hey, knock yourself out.
I don't remember, know.
MTV was pretty gaudy in 1998, so maybe, I don't know. Too much Bill Bellamy or something.
Yeah, maybe he just wasn't a big TRL fan. I don't know, but maybe he didn't like the boy bands. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, he likes Korn. He wanted Korn to beat the boy bands on TRL, and they never did. So
sure. Yeah, absolutely. I could see Larry being a big Korn fan, you know.
He likes corn. I'm sure he loves corn. So,
right,
you know, corn the food and growing corn. So I don't know why he wouldn't like the band corn. So
he's a new metal guy, So and this is I'd forgotten to include this earlier, so I'm gonna throw it in now. This is from actually early on in the season. This is Jackie McMullen from a piece I think in the season preview on NBA feuds, and mentioned that Larry Bird versus the Boston Celtics. And of course, this was, you know, Larry was new as the coach, and he was a member of the Celtics front office for 5 years, ostensibly after he retired before he went to the Pacers, but was. You know, felt like ownership and management ignored his suggestions on trades, hiring, and draft picks. So, you know, he went elsewhere. And then he openly blasted Dee Brown, who was in Boston and his former teammate, saying that he would get hurt and he wasn't worth his $3.5 million salary. And Red Auerbach was mad about that. And, you know, the rest of the, Rapetino, all those guys were not thrilled about that. So interesting shade being thrown at Larry there. You don't hear a lot about kind of the post, like after he left the Celtics, and him throwing shade on the team. And so a little bit of that's notable here.
Yeah, it's like, dude, let the man get his money. Like, okay, it's not your problem. Like,
dude, yeah, I don't know. Maybe just didn't like playing with D. Brown. I don't know. Yeah, it seems like a random guy to throw up. Maybe they just didn't get along when they played. I don't know.
Too much MTV for D. Brown. But yeah, no, it's interesting to look at the Pacers, and they were definitely a great defensive team. And I think one of the things, that, and you sort of mentioned it, was depth. I mean, they were like eight deep of like all solid players. You had Miller, Smits, Mullen, Davis, Rose, Mark Jackson, like Dale Davis. So like, you're talking, there's a solid like 10 guys that could just go, but nobody, like you said, not one star, not really one emerging guy other than Reggie. But he's really on kind of, whenever we talk about Reggie, and I think at this point, especially in his career, he's not like you said, the killer that like, okay, look, we got Reggie, like we're good to go, we're gonna win X amount of games. He's a great, you know, he's gonna score you 20 points or whatever, but it's not like he's like, we're talking about Malone and Jordan and those, like Shaq or whatever, those dudes that are just gonna like, they're on your team, you're gonna win, you know, the more of your games. Reggie Miller wasn't that quite type of player at that point in his career or whatever, really, right. I don't know if he ever quite was, but he was a great asset for that team because he was good at being the best guy on a really deep team as well. So that was definitely their big benefit there. I mean, it really is interesting to see how deep that team went.
Right. Yeah. And you know, Ben Taylor's done his great, greatest of all time series at Backpicks. And he, you know, brought some things about Reggie that I think are interesting. And we knew that, you know, he was one of the first, you know, heavy point scoring guards to really use the three pointer as a weapon, and how much that kind of meant. And so it, like, in one sense, he wasn't like the, you know, you compare him to like Mitch Richmond. Like Mitch Richmond was like a guy who was like more traditional guard skills of the 90s, where he's gonna beat you off the dribble, stuff like that. Like Reggie didn't necessarily have those skills, but his effectiveness scoring threes, even though his point totals weren't always like gaudy compared to a lot of the other guards in the league, his effectiveness benefited the team from that way. So like, yeah, he could carry you like in a certain way, but he didn't carry you like in the traditional way where it was going to be like, you know, go out there, you know, try to beat somebody off the dribble and, you know, make that last basket. It was more
coming off
the screen, getting the three. And obviously, you know, he has a litany of great playoff moments. So we know that he, you know, would step up in the big time, and in the playoffs, he did tend to play better. So, you know, he had that going for him, but it was just a different way of, you know, being great than, you know, was kind of traditional, especially at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So next we have the Lakers, who after the All-Star break struggled a little bit, and there's a little bit of smoke at this point in the Shaq and Kobe relationship. There were, some rumors of Shaq being jealous of things like jersey sales and accusing Kobe of playing basketball, of selfish basketball, like in 97 and 98. Kobe gets his first All-Star appearance here. Is sort of getting his first taste of real stardom going on at this point, even though he was only a sixth man for the Lakers. Although there was nothing like super public about it, it was more just, you know, in retrospect, you know, stuff that was that's been written later that, you know, said like, okay, yeah, there was a little bit going on here as Kobe started, you know, to ascend to some stardom. And and the Lakers did struggle after the All-Star break. They lost 7 of 12. Kobe had a stretch where he only made 30 of 100 shots. Shaq, didn't really want to wait for Kobe to mature as a player. And Del Harris specifically thought that NBA and NBC were overexposing Kobe and that he became more of a one-on-one player after the break. And you did dug into a little bit more as well.
Yeah, there was a Rolling Stone article at the time, you know, sort of not necessarily alluding to the feud between them, more it was kind of a personality piece about Kobe Bryant and more about like, hey, here's this emerging star in the NBA. But some of the quotes kind of allude to like, there's some things that, Dell and Shaq aren't and totally in love with. And of course, it was before the All-Star break. You know, Bryant was shooting 45% and averaging about 18 points a game afterwards. It dropped to, 34% and 14 points. But, you know, and there's a quote from Kobe saying it's, you know, it's important to tone it down somewhat and stay within the team concept, but I'm aggressive. It's also important not to lose the aggressiveness. And then Del Harris says, you know, everybody is pushing too quickly and too much. He has so many forces pulling at him. He's a conglomerate already. So that's an interesting thing there. I forgot what Shaq had a name for him at this time, and I forgot to copy it down, but forget what it was. But it was something like
Showboat?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, he's like, hey, that's their showboat. And it's like one of those things that, you know, at the time you're probably like, aha, that's a fun. But knowing in retrospect what he was actually thinking at the time, and knowing what we know, like you see the showboat thing, and you're like, oh, that's playful, and it's like, like to an extent it is, but it's also Shaq being like, because there's quotes where he's like, ah, yeah, go talk to Showboat, he'll tell you, or yeah, oh yeah, well, ask Showboat or whatever, and you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of playful, you know, joking around between the teammates, but it really wasn't. So. Yeah, and then it said here in that article that Harris keeps track of stats of how often a player shoots the ball per minute played. O'Neal is number one in the league, Michael Jordan is second, and Bryant is third. No matter how you do the math, O'Neal and Bryant can't share that many minutes unless Bryant passes the ball. So this was in that Rolling Stone piece, which is meant to be sort of a reflection, a positive reflection of Kobe, but you see some of these things in here, and you see how it's kind of simmering a little bit here. And here's Del Harris says, it causes a rift between us because I'm trying to get him to give up the ball, and he feels that his game is to take on the world. So Kobe wants to take on the world. Del Harris is trying to tell him to pass the ball a little bit. Shaq sort of alluding to it to an extent. So it didn't go well. And of course, you mentioned the All-Star game, and that was a huge thing as well. He doesn't play in the fourth quarter of the All-Star game. This is the first All-Star game very early in his career to be already in the All-Star game, you know, as you said, as a sixth man or whatever. But it was in Detroit, and it was written that, you know, Gary Payton, David Robinson, and Karl Malone were all, quote, completely fed up with Bryant's selfishness and total disregard for winning the game and executed the freeze out. So Kobe got frozen out of the All-Star game because they thought he was doing a lot of one-on-one trying to really be the guy. And to be fair, they were sort of, the NBA was promoting him a lot because the NBA was really getting ready for, you know, post-Jordan era and trying to build up new stars. And Kobe was one of the guys that they, you know, correctly pegged as, hey, this guy could be the, you know, the guy, but it was a little too much too early for some of his teammates and his coaches and other guys around the league.
Yes. A note there, the All-Star game was in New York. I don't know why it says in Detroit here, but the note was from the Detroit News. No, not your fault. It was written wrong by me, but I wanted to clarify that. There's another quote from Del Harris, who this is from the AP, I believe. He said, I expected Kobe do well in the All-Star game, and he did. But on our team, he fulfills an important role, coming off the bench to provide a spark. It's also good for him to that the opponent doesn't know if he's coming in at forward or guard and can't set his defense for him. So he kind of showed some flexibility doing that. So interesting interesting look at kind of the early dynamics of Kobe and Shaq and Kobe, particularly on this Lakers team, who, you know, had a lot of talent, had been had actually done pretty well in, you know, Shaq was out for about a month and they, you know, right, they were fine there. They were, you know, at the top of the league. They got off to a really great start, and they're still, you know, we'll look at the standings a little bit later, but they're still, you know, very, very close to being at the top, but definitely, you know, fell off a little bit here.
Yeah, certainly.
And looking at another team that had not had much success in the league. In fact, this is their first season with a winning record, the Minnesota Timberwolves. And Kevin Garnett and Stephon Marbury really establishing themselves as two top guys in the NBA. Garnett with 18.5 points per game, 9.6 rebounds, selected for the All-Star game for the second year. This was his third year in the league. He's 21 years old, I believe, 2021. And Marbury's up there too. He's really, playing really well. 17.7 points per game, 8.6 assists. And the one sour note during this month is that kind of the third star, Tom Gugliotta, who was also playing really well and was actually the leading scorer, 21.1 points per game, had season-ending ankle surgery, and this was also at a point where he could opt out of his contract and become a free agent. He had 2 years left on a 5-year, $27 million deal, but, you know, could obviously opt out and get bigger money elsewhere. With the lockout looming, there's a lot of uncertainty there, but, you know, that's a pretty good core three that they had, and unfortunately, we'll get to much later, things didn't really work out there, but definitely had a, this is their first sign of, like, hey, this could be potentially a good team down the road, and things are, for the most part, looking pretty good at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And Google out of there's some contention as well, because this is, you know, the final year of it. So he's got a deal that he's got 2 years remaining on a 5-year deal, but he can opt out of his contract this summer to become a free agent. So obviously, you know, the ankle injury comes at a really terrible time for him and for the team as well, who's really kind of emerging. But you really look at it and the team, I don't know that necessarily, I mean, obviously having Gugliotta would be awesome, but it's with Garnett and Marbury, you're looking at, hey, they might not even need Gugliotta. And if he moves on, you know, that might be okay, because we can just go to Kevin Garnett. And that's cool to see Garnett really emerging as well and really becoming, you know, a star into his own right, because as you know, obviously one of the few, or you know, with Kobe coming out of high school and Garnett coming out of high school, there was still the worries about, okay, what are these guys going to do in the league? And Garnett wasn't, you know, immediately great, and it was, there were questions about, you know, what would he be able to do, and would he be able to transfer? And obviously at this point we're seeing at 2021 he's coming, and he's, you know, it's not going to stop. So it's cool to see that. But interesting note here as well, on February 18th the Minnesota Timberwolves traded away the last original player from their 1989 inaugural season as Doug West got traded to the Grizzlies. But Doug did not take this very well. He was peeved, especially since he was allegedly told by the Wolves that he would not be traded. Not only did they renege on that, they traded him to a losing franchise. And according to HoopsHype.com, upon hearing of this trade, West drank 17 Heinekens and went into rehab, which is not totally a joke or an exaggeration, because he did actually go to rehab around this time. I don't know about the Heinekens. I have no idea. And obviously, it was probably an issue that was happening much before this. But yeah, he actually did check into rehab briefly. And then he would eventually report to the Grizzlies and actually become a pretty good player on that team. Definitely like a veteran leader. Doug West is never a guy that was like great on any level or whatever. He's fine for a number of years, but yeah, it was kind of interesting to see him take on the role of, you know, he initially didn't want to go to the Vancouver, initially didn't want to do that, but then ended up, you know, kind of, I think, enjoying his time there a little bit and becoming a good veteran for that franchise.
Yeah, and you know, some of the other notable guys who were on the Wolves at this time, of course, Sam Mitchell, Mr. Timberwolf, Terry Porter, toward the end of his career, you know, was performing well. You know, they had a number of interesting guys going on there. So, you know, having some success there. Yeah, I
wish Sam didn't go to Indiana. I forget that he had that little brief, because I'm looking at his thing. I was like, what about Sam Mitchell? He was on the original team, but he went to Indiana for a few years, because he would have been awesome. He started in 89 and then ended in 02. So he would have had a really good run. Stupid Indiana.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it would have been. I don't know how well Gugliotta would have fit in with Garnett and Marbury, because I don't know if there's some overlap between Gugliotta and Garnett. Gugliotta was also 28, so he was on an older. I thought he was a bit younger at this point, so he was on, you know, obviously not quite on the same timeline as Garnett, who was 21, Marbury, who was 20. So, you know, like that might have been good for the next couple of years, but long term, obviously, you know, that wasn't gonna totally fit real well. But yeah, they certainly, you know, some more exciting things are going on for the Timberwolves, at least for this season. Yeah, they didn't start off that great, but they really, you know, were picking it up and were obviously playing real well. And the
also
final
Cherokee
thing
Parks, by the way. You forgot to mention Cherokee Parks, but that's all right.
I did forget to mention Cherokee Parks. Yes, how could I have forgotten to mention Cherokee Parks? I don't know. So, yes, Anthony Peeler as well. So Anthony Peeler was there as well. So good times. And the next team, the New Jersey Nets, were in year two of the John Calipari era, and they're in the playoff hunt after a 26-win season the year before, and definitely, you know, a pretty overhauled roster as well. They have Keith Van Horn as a rookie who was out for first month and a half or so, but is playing pretty well for the season. He'd end up averaging 19.7 points per game, 6.6 rebounds on 5-16 true shooting percentage, which isn't great, but for, you know, rookie kind of asked to take a big role on the team, that's not terrible. Jason Williams was absolutely a rebound machine, had a lot of 20 rebound games and would end up averaging 12.9 points per game, 13.6 rebounds per game, and there's a lot of talent there. Sam Cassell, of course, who had come over the year before in a trade, and Kerry Kittles, Kendall Gill, Sherman Douglas, Chris Gatling, who had dealt with a facial paralysis issue the year before and was performing pretty well this year for the most part, so was contributing to the team. And they would actually end up in this month trading for Ronnie Cicely, which we're going to get into in a little bit, because that unfortunately did not work out for the Nets. But definitely an interesting team there. Cassell, you know, playing extremely well, 19.6 points per game, 8 assists per game. Things are looking up. It looks like they're the John Calipari era is going to really work out for
them. Cal thing's going to work. The Nets are going to – Cal's staying. The Nets are staying. I mean, this is a team for the future right here. I'm liking everything that's going on here. So
yes, so it is notable, a couple things about Calipari. One is that he was under investigation at this point for some alleged improprieties that went on when he was coaching at Massachusetts. I'm sure nothing will come of that. I'm sure there's no problem there. Yeah.
I'm sure he's done nothing wrong.
Absolutely. And then during a loss to the Heat, he showered a profanity at a fan, which ended up resulting in a fine from the league. During the game, he turned to a heckler and shouted, "You shut your mouth, shut the expletive up." So, and he later said, "In the emotion of the moment, I said something I shouldn't have said." So, very bad John Calipari cursing at fans.
Yeah, and that was his home crowd too, right? so presumably it was a Nets fan that was heckling.
Yes, it was. It was a Nets fan, in fact. So they do exist. They existed at the time. So, and they do exist, I'm sure, still. You know,
there's got to be one. I don't know who. I've never met one, but I'm sure there's one.
Right. Yes. So, and now we're going to look at the four most interesting games of the month. This, of course, is very subjective. So if we forgot your game, then we very much apologize. But the first choice here is from February 4th, the Jazz overcoming a 24-point deficit to the Bulls and beating the Bulls at home. They actually swept the season series 2-0. Of course, this was the rematch from the 97 finals, and as was gone in during the game, everyone, it could possibly be Jordan's final game in Salt Lake City. Of course, everyone hoping that Jazz fans hoping that they would make the finals and presumably would meet Jordan in the finals again. And Jordan did fine. He scored 40 points, although did tire a little bit down the stretch, although he had 11 points in the fourth quarter. But the Jazz comeback was sparked by who else? Chris Morris, of course.
Everybody knows that. Everybody remembers the Chris Morris game, of course, is this one that you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes, Chris Morris. He was able to pick things up in the second quarter, and then Stockton, Malone, Jeff Hornacek, and Byron Russell picked things up in the second half. Malone, particularly in the third quarter, had 12 points on 6-7 from the field. For the game, Malone finished with 30 points and 8 rebounds. Stockton had 17 points and 18 assists, so a good game for them. Pippen went out early with a sore hamstring, so Kukoc and Steve Kerr were already out of the game, so obviously the Bulls were a bit shorthanded for this effort, but still, pretty impressive win for the Jazz there.
Yeah, definitely. And you're reading that the quote there. That's pretty funny from the Desert News. If it was MJ's final bow in Salt Lake City, he gave the fans their money's worth. Well, whoops. It would he'd have, I think, a few more in there, including one.
Yes.
That, but they're very happy right now. Hey, it's Michael Jordan. The last game in Salt Lake City. Yeah. Yay. I'm sure they were less happy, a few months later. But
It was a little sadness there. But our next is, of course, the Tracy Murray 50-point game one of the more random 50-point game performers there. During that game, Rod Strickland also had 20 assists during the game. And it was notable because Strickland and Murray had infamously gotten into a fight at a hotel just a few months before this.
Yep, we talked about that
on a previous episode. And Bullets Forever is a nice post on the game and notes that if you watch the highlight of Murray's performance that game, you just see how much of a role Strickland really does in making it work. He actually sets up Murray on all 13 of the shots that he made in the or 13 of the games that shots that he made out of 18. Murray attempted 29 shots, made 18 of them, and it was 10 points more than he had ever scored in his career. He also had 0 assists in the game, but Strickland himself, he had 21 points, 20 assists, and 12 rebounds.
That's a great game.
Only one of 4 players since 83 to have a triple-double with 20 points and 20 assists, at least at the time. I don't believe it's been done since then that I can recall. He set up 27 of the team's 37 field goals and 13 of the team's 26 free throw attempts. So, Strickland obviously doing a lot to make that work. It was against the lowly Warriors, of course, were not good that season. So, some caveats there. But hey, 50 points, 50 points. And, a 2020 game is a 2020 game. So.
Yeah, no, it's definitely another fun stat from that Bolts Forever thing, too, is that only 3 of the team's assists that night came from someone other than Rod Strickland. So that's the impact that he has on that is incredible, too. But yeah, just a very random one, the Tracy Murray 50-point game. And he goes in the pantheon of random. He joins the Tony Delks of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Eventually, in about 15 years, the Brandon Jennings of the world says,
sure.
The weird. Right now, it's still kind of Brandon Jennings is fine. But yeah, in 10 years, we'll definitely be mentioning him.
I don't think Brandon Jennings is quite as random as some of the other ones. But the Corey Brewers. The Andre Miller's.
Oh, the recent Corey Brewer. I forget about that one. It wasn't peak Corey Brewer. It was post-peak, quote peak Corey Brewer just randomly dropping 50 for no reason. That's an incredible one. This Tracy Murray one is definitely in the pantheon, though. I forget about this one a lot.
Absolutely. We'll have to a good future show idea is looking at the most random 50-point games, deciding which one is the most unlikely. So we'll have to add that to the list. Shaquille O'Neal returning to Orlando finally on February 22nd. He had been injured the year before, so when the Lakers had gone to Orlando, so he had been booed significantly during that time, and the Magic actually won the game 96-94. Nick Anderson had a 3-pointer with 7.1 seconds remaining. Shaq had a good enough game, 20 points, 10 rebounds, but the Magic pulled it out. And there's some notes during the game. During player introductions, Shaq was seen and heard saying, "Shut the F up" to the crowd more than once as they booed his introduction. before tip-off, the Magic played portions of the following songs. I'm a Loser by the Beatles, and Carly Simon's You're So Vain, and then Steve Miller Band. Of course, you know, we all know how I feel about the Steve Miller Band. Take the Money and Run, and Would I Lie to You by the Eurythmics. So the Magic Game Ops being a little petty there. And then afterward, some quotes from Shaq. Am I going to go home and drink a whole bottle of Pine Sol? No, we've just got to move on. They did what they were supposed to do to win a home game. And then he says that every arena I go to, I get booed. And then a reporter said, well, this is the arena you used to get cheered. And Shaq said, used to. I used to drive a Porsche, but I don't anymore. I've moved on. So, and then Nick Anderson, he said that his quote was, let him make his little comments about whatever he wants to. As a team, this is a good victory. I'm more happy for the fans than anything. They've been waiting for this day to come. So it's definitely some – apparently Nick Anderson and Shaq did not really get along during their time there. So whatever that is worth.
Yeah, and there's a Shaquille O'Neal quote too, like before he signed with the Lakers, and he called Orlando a dried up little pond, which is not great, even though I think he still lives there, like to this day, but you know,
right.
not great, but you know, emotions, a lot of emotions flying at that time. And yeah, if you go into nuts and bolts of the contract negotiates and all that sort of stuff, it wasn't like, you know, I don't know. It's a show for another, you know, a debate for another day. But yeah, it's not like Shaq just, you know, was completely, you know, one-sided thing where he just totally, you know, dogged the entire franchise. It was, you know, they played a little part in that as well. But yeah, the Game Ops definitely took the opportunity to really drive the hammer in there and really just stick the knife in and turn it. But I think Shaq would get the last laugh many, many, many times over. So
yes. And then for the first time in NBA history, a team doubled the opponent's score. The Pacers defeated the Blazers 124-59, which at the time was the second largest margin of victory in NBA history. The only one that was worse was when the Cavs beat the Heat 148-80 in 1991. Previously, the closest that a team had come doubling its opponent's point total was 1951, which is before the shot clock, of course. The Lakers had beaten the Hawks 99-51, and the Blazers barely surpassed the NBA record low of 57 points. That, of course, is the shot clock record low, because obviously there's the 1918 infamous game that happened before the shot clock. And this happened on your birthday,
yeah,
Rich.
I remember it well. I was sitting with my friends eating cake and watching the Pacers and the Trailblazers, of course, this giant blowout. But no, definitely a great birthday gift here. But so the Blazers' leading scorer in this game was Rasheed Wallace. He had 14, and then they had only three players in double figures other than that, which is not ideal. Indiana had eight players in double figures and two more with 8 points. So that's kind of interesting. We talked about a little earlier of Indiana's like super balanced team, and this is a great example of eight players in double figures, and then nobody really scores more than 18. Mark Jackson has 18, and that's your leading. But everybody, like almost everybody, gets in the game and gets, you know, almost a double figure. So definitely an interesting one here. And yeah, the 65-point margin, you said, second largest in the history. And yeah, just an incredible display of blowout. I don't know. Yeah, it's uncharacteristic, too, because the Blazers were a pretty good team this year. But just, you know, you had a bad night.
Yeah, and this was after the Damon Stoudemire-Kenny Anderson trade, which we'll get into in a little bit. But the Blazers were a perfectly balanced team. It's funny because actually Rasheed's total, I believe, was the second most of anybody in the game, or tied for the second most of anybody in the game. So I guess somebody had to lead the Blazers in scoring. So, it's funny that Indiana's came with such balance. Interesting. And obviously it was a blowout pretty much from the start, so there wasn't going to be a whole lot of opportunity for, you know, any one guy to dominate. I'm sure they balanced gave guys rest and all that good stuff. But yeah, that's interesting stuff. So
yeah, the Blazers, if you look too. Oh, sorry, real quick. The Blazers, I'm looking at the box score here, real quick. They were 8-19 from the free throw line. That's definitely not great. You definitely want to be better than that. No. But and then 3-17 from three. So again, not great. So it wasn't just, you know, they weren't hitting some of their shots. They were missing everything.
Yeah, and the Blazers, you know, they had perfectly, you know, they had Sabonis in that game. They had good players. You know, it wasn't like they were a terrible team or anything. They were a pretty solid team that year. But for whatever reason, not a good night for them. So we're going to dig in a little bit into some of the major events of the month. I think the biggest one is Latrell Sprewell's arbitration hearing and the decision being made there. The hearing actually started in late January, but it ramped up a lot in February. We talked about it a little bit, but we'll get into it just a little bit more here. We'll just talk about some of the highlights because there's a lot to this, and not all of it's really super interesting. But So Arn Tellem testified. Spree was an agent and talked about an incident in the fall of 1990 when Alan Bristow, who we'll talk about a little bit later, he was the Hornets VP of basketball operations, reportedly choked Tellem during negotiations for Kendall Gill. And Craig Sager did some reporting here saying that after Bristow apologized and agreed to pay any medical expenses for Tellem's sore neck, the only action taken by the league against Bristow was a verbal reprimand. So setting some precedent there for what might happen in a physical confrontation like that. Obviously not involving a player, but still, you know, I can see the parallels there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a... Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so among the testimony was involved was Warriors GM Gary St. John, who was there for nearly 4 hours in the second week. PJ Carlissimo, of course, testified, and also there was some the Players Association was upset that Carlissimo was present during testimony from his players last week, feeling that it reeked of witness intimidation. And David Stern also talking about how he felt the need to step in on these issues because he felt like the teams were less willing to step up. The pressure on winning is making our teams more reluctant to offend their players. And he says, overall, the responses have not been stellar. Carlissimo testified for 7 hours talking about there was some question about whether the second attack actually took place and what like it really involved. Whether Sprewell, no one questions whether that Sprewell actually tried to go after Carlissimo. The question was whether he actually, you know, hit him and what happened there. But he said that yes, there was the second attack and saying that Sprewell did hit him and said that I'll kill you, and that Sprewell had said that, you know, he was held back by teammates before contact was made. Stern himself testified for nearly 5 hours in there, and then afterward talked about he felt as though the stand taken by the leagues and the Warriors had a good chance of being upheld. He said he's very uncomfortable with our actions. I feel comfortable that I've acquitted myself the way that I'm supposed to. And that leads to about a month later where the decision is made and the arbitrator, John Feerick, reduced Sprewell's ban by 5 months and reinstated his contract with the Warriors, more importantly, which had been canceled by the team. So still one of the more severe penalties in NBA history. In fact, the most for non-drug related penalties. But he was going to be allowed to rejoin the team by July 1st and have the final 2 years of his contract. He still would lose $6.4 million. Not a significant punishment, but he got a lot out of that. And the NBA was definitely as surprised by that reaction.
No, it definitely appeared to be a lot worse than it was going to be, you know, initially, and to see what was going to happen and of the, you know, big bravado of what was going to, you know, be, you know, brought down. And it was far less than I think anybody expected. And you know, judging the fairness, like, again, we're still having trouble even to this day trying to figure out what exactly happened and what was fair and what wasn't fair or whatever. But yeah, given a lot of the bravado when it first started, I was pretty stunned too to see it be as low as it was, given, yeah, just how big the NBA did and how, but, you know, hey, these things sort of happen. And yeah, again, the fairness of it, who knows? We don't know all the details about it, and it's, we weren't really privy to, you know, what happened in the second thing, or right, if the second thing even happened or whatever. So
the specifics exactly of there, and you know, obviously we talked about before where because of the public, just of how visible this became for the NBA, that obviously changed what, you know, the reaction might have been based on if it had been something that was, you know, less high profile. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, David Stern publicly not happy about the reaction, said, called it a very charitable decision from the arbitrator, said it missed the opportunity to send a message with respect to the broader standard of all the good things that sports leagues can stand for. On that basis, we're more than a little disappointed. David Stern definitely not happy with how things went there. Afterward, Latrell Sprewell did some interviews, including one with 60 Minutes, where he said, I wasn't choking PJ. PJ, he could breathe. It's not like he was losing air or anything like that. I mean, it wasn't a choke. I wasn't trying to kill PJ.
I was just gently placing my hands around his neck. I wasn't trying to choke him.
He also said... Yeah, he kind of followed along with his, you know, second time story where it said players tried to keep him from getting closer. He said, I think when that happened, I just started swinging my arms just to get free from those guys. This is where they say PJ was punched or something. I know that I didn't intentionally go out there to hit PJ. And then asked if he needed counseling. He said, no, I don't feel I need counseling. And then he was asked if he got away with attacking him. And I said, well, I attacked him, but I don't know about getting away with it. It costs $6.5 million in 68 games. So, which I'll go along with that. Yeah, that's not quite getting away with it. But certainly, so that kind of closes the chapter on that for the most part. We'll get into that when after the season ends, there'll be some things there. But that's basically that's the end of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Saga is over.
So, yes. So, at the beginning of the month, Doug Collins is fired and Alvin Gentry becomes the Pistons coach. We kind of saw this coming based on some of the things that Doug had said over the season and not really seeming very happy with Detroit and the team not seeing very happy with him. And it's more of the quotes that came from this that are funny, you know, about it. Brian Williams said, the feature Bison Daily, you know, said a couple of things about how, you know, that. I've become increasingly aware that Doug won games and the players lost them. If you won a game, you were the greatest. If you lost, you were worthless. And Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan even said they weren't surprised by Collins' firing. And Jordan said the rhythm between the coach and the players wasn't peaceful. That put a lot of strain on the team. It was probably the best thing for both parties. And Pippen said he has been in some difficult situations. He hasn't been able to develop the relationships that can keep him in an organization. So it sounds like neither guy particularly cared much for being coached by Doug Collins.
No, yeah, and that was the thing that you can contend. And we talked about it a few episodes ago. Like Doug was I forgot what the quote that he said, but it was essentially like, you know, this, but like don't blame me. It's not my fault we lose or something like that. It was, you know, just right. It's kind of the Doug Collins thing, you know, that he would always do that. But yeah, I'm not surprised that Doug Collins was left, and Doug's a guy that kind of grinds on people time and time again, so gets, you know, the most out of players for a few. It's similar to like a Scott Skiles type, or there's a few other guys that like it works for like 2 years and everyone's just kind of like, all right, we're kind of done with you, can you go away now, you're kind of annoying. So yeah, it was not a surprise that Doug was jettisoned at this point.
So there were also some rumors that the Pistons were going to bring back some of the old Bad Boys people into management roles or coaching roles. There was talk about Rick Mahorn, Bill Laimbeer, and even Joe Dumars is after he retired, you know, becoming a gaining a manager position. Even Dumars was talked about as general manager. And then Pistons president said, I know. Yeah, of course not. You know, the Pistons president said, no matter who becomes the new coach, Grant Hill will take an active role in that hiring. I don't know if I've ever seen this actually outright said. Wilson said, in the last 10 years in this league, I don't think there has been a head coach who has been hired where the superstar wasn't consulted. Whoever it might be, if Hill doesn't want to play for him, it's not going to happen. So I don't think I've ever seen it put that bluntly before by, you know, an executive on a team.
Yeah, right. Like it's always sort of alluded to or rumored about or kind of said, but yeah, no, players don't really want to own that either. Like that's also something that you don't necessarily want to, and it kind of puts that player out on a different like island compared to the rest of the team. You know what I mean? Like, hey, you know, like there's obviously the implication, like LeBron obviously was not a big fan of David Blatt and David Blatt was sent away or whatever, but yeah, it wasn't LeBron said that David Blatt had to go, you know, wasn't the quote, and the owner, you know, Dan Gilbert wasn't like, yeah, we fired David Blatt because LeBron hated him. Like that's not, yeah, you don't really do that. It's kind of a weird quote there, but. I guess put all your balls in the Grant Hill court. That's going to definitely work out pretty well, I think. So
sure. Of course, February All-Star Weekend. Jeff Hornacek won the three-point contest. Zygrunas Ilgauskas was the MVP in the rookie game with 18 points. Tim Duncan did not play in it because he played in the All-Star game itself. Clyde Drexler and Cynthia Cooper won the two-ball competition. Of course, there was no slam dunk this contest this year. The two-ball competition replaced it. And, yeah, did not get great reaction from sports writers for the fans in general. People, you know, a little bit upset about the dunk contest going on. We kind of talked about all that before. The game itself, there were no All-Star uniforms this year. Players wore their own jerseys. Rich, how do you feel about that?
I don't like it. I like some uniforms, but I guess the way that they've had the uniforms lately, I guess it wouldn't like the last year and this year's were pretty bad. But no, I like the idea of everybody wearing the same kind of themed uniform or whatever. So I don't know. I mean, I don't hate it. I just, I don't know. I think it kind of looks a little silly. So I prefer everybody wearing, you know, a one uniform jersey.
Yeah, I agreed with that. Michael Jordan, he had 23 points, 6 rebounds, and 8 assists, was the MVP of the game, and was the oldest All-Star Game MVP, winning 9 days before his 35th birthday. The East won the game 135-114, and 4 Lakers were played in the game, Nick Van Exel, Eddie Jones, Shaquille O'Neal, and Kobe Bryant, which is the first time since 83 that 4 players from the same team were selected to play in the same All-Star game. The Sixers of that year were selected, so that was notable. Anything else to talk about with All-Star weekend?
Nothing else. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you had the two ball, the debut of two ball, and that did not go well. I think the AP's time reader said two ball, too dull.
Very clever. Yes.
Two ball did not replace the dunk contest, but it was a decent concept, but yeah, it just didn't quite work, didn't quite grab the imagination of people. But then again, the dunk contest hadn't really grabbed the imagination for a few years either. So NBA is still trying to figure out what to do with this this NBA Saturday as it kind of floats in space right now, trying to figure out what's best for the weekend. So.
Right, exactly. So, trade deadline, and notable this year happening after the All-Star game. A few rumors ahead of the deadline. I'm sure there were plenty of others, but some ones that stood out to me is there were apparently talk of the 76ers trading Allen Iverson to the Magic for Penny Hardaway, which, of course, would have been very shocking. Both parties denied this. In fact, Alex Martins, who's a spokesman for the Magic, saying, "It's not happening. I know that for a fact. I think it's safe to say we don't want Allen Iverson." So, of course.
Jeez.
Yeah, of course. Iverson.
Maybe don't say that. Like, maybe, yeah. You know, he could be a free agent at some point. Like, you might want to, yeah, you know, geez. Maybe. All right. I mean, okay.
Yeah. And Billy King said that the Sixers made some inquiries about whether Hardaway might be moving to a new team before the trade deadline, but that was the extent of their interest. Also talk about Mitch Richmond trade scenarios, including going to the Heat in a trade involving Isaac Austin. He was very public about talked about wanting a trade, and you know, he said, "Hey, do the Kings want to keep me here with the young guys? You know, I need to sit down with Jeff Petrie and figure out what, you know, what's going to go on if I'm not traded," that kind of thing. John Calipari said that there was rumors about a trade that would have sent Kendall Gill and Sam Cassell to the Raptors for Damon Stoudemire and Walt Williams, but Calipari said, "Oh, the trade is dead." And part of the reason why it didn't happen is because Kendall Gill said that, "I'm not going to a losing team point blank," and did not want to go to Toronto. A lot of guys didn't want to go to Toronto, which we'll talk about in a minute. Finally, the actual trades. The Raptors, part of a large trade, sent Carlos Rogers, Damon Stoudemire, and Walt Williams to the Trailblazers for Kenny Anderson, Gary Trent, Alvin Williams, and 2 first-round picks and a second-round pick. That's a big blockbuster. That's a part of a very big Raptors overhaul that we'll get into in a minute. And a very interesting trade, Orlando sending Ronnie Cicely to Utah for Chris Morris, Greg Foster, and a 1998 first-round pick. Of course, we all know Ronnie Cicely went to the Jazz, you know, helped them on their road to the championship. That, of course, worked out perfectly well for that team.
Yeah, and then retired and became a world-renowned DJ. Some of those things are true.
Yeah, one absolutely.
Two facts, one of them
DJ
is true.
A DJ based in Utah.
Yeah.
That's weird. Salt Lake City DJs. You wouldn't have thought that would be huge, but, you know. Is it true that Ronnie Cicely is one of the...
No, he's actually like a DJ. No, he's like legitimately a DJ.
Well, I know he's a DJ.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I have no idea.
Is he one of the Quad City DJs is the question.
Oh, the Quad
City. It's the Quad City DJs, not the Quad Cities DJs.
Right. Because
they're not from the Quad Cities.
Exactly.
They're a Quad
City DJs. We saw them
on
All-Star Weekend this past weekend. I was amazed they came out, and I was like, hey.
Yeah.
But they weren't. There was
right
only
in
two
the train
of them.
Once so again.
The Quad City DJs doesn't quite work when there's only two of them. But, hey, you know what?
Yeah.
I can tell them how to do their job. So
maybe they should add Ronnie Cicely to the, you know... It's just a thought, you know. NBA connection makes sense, you know. Jim Jackson and Clarence Witherspoon go from the 76ers to the Golden State Warriors for Brian Shaw and Joe Smith. Jim Jackson, of course, this is the second year in a row he's been traded, and that's going to continue for quite a while. There's going to be a lot of Jim Jackson trades in the future.
Yeah, get used to that. Strap in for the annual Jim Jackson's traded discussion, because it's going to happen a long time.
It'll be fun. The Ronnie Cicely trade, unfortunately, voided just a couple of days later. There was some dispute about why this happened. There was a stress fracture in his right foot, so he was going to not be able to play for about a month. The Jazz said that, he wanted us to guarantee a couple of years of his contract that were non-guaranteed, and Yes, Karl Malone called Cycli a con man, and Utah owner Larry Miller said that they were trying to get contractual concessions. Cycli said, hey, they're just speed about my injury, nothing else. The guys who were traded for Cycli, Greg Foster and Chris Morris, were they had split opinions about their return to Utah. Greg Foster was happy. There's no other place I'd rather be right here. And Chris Morris was the least used Jazz player, who was, of course, helpful in that Bulls game, but otherwise said, I'm angry that I'm here. I was looking forward to going out there and playing. So it's a thing. Given the injuries, I'm not sure how well Cycli would have done, because you know he would end up playing he would end up getting traded to the Nets and not play particularly well and would be hurt. But if he had been healthy, that's sort of an interesting what if on whether he could have really helped the Jazz all that much or not.
Yeah, it's interesting. And those guys that obviously stayed there, they played okay roles as well as it went on. Like especially Greg Foster, I know he played decent bench roles, and Chris Morris did a few things here and there. So I don't know. Yeah, I guess it. I don't think it hurt them all that much. Like, but it would be interesting to see just what Cycli could have done. But yeah, knowing sort of how Cycli would play the rest of the year, it's hard. It's hard to believe that would have helped them a ton, but yeah, I don't know. It's one of those interesting what-if scenarios, but I think it was probably all right that it got voided. It wasn't like it completely destroyed their season, of course, but yeah, it is an interesting what-if, what would have happened there. But yeah, Chris Morris really not enjoying his stay in Utah. But
no, not happy, no, yeah. So the Kenny Anderson, once he was traded to the Raptors, was like, I don't want to play in Toronto. So they ended up trading him to Boston for along with Popeye Jones and Zan Tabak to for Chauncey Billups, a rookie, D. Brown. So I guess he's leaving. Maybe he's leaving Boston because Larry Bird made fun of him. Roy Rogers and John Thomas. So they are going to Toronto. A few other notable trades. The Suns traded Cedric Sabalas for the second time, going to the Dallas Mavericks for Dennis Scott. The Kings traded Bobby Hurley and Michael Smith to the Grizzlies for Chris Robinson and Otis Thorpe. Also, the Grizzlies traded Anthony Peeler to the Timberwolves for Doug West. We talked about that a little bit earlier. The Heat did make a trade, not for Mitch Richmond, but they traded Isaac Austin, Charles Smith, and a first-round pick for the Clippers for Brent Berry. The Nets... the Cycli trade that did happen, the Nets sent three players and a first-round pick to the Magic for Brian Evans and Cycli. And then the Bulls traded Jason Caffey to the Warriors for David Bond and two second-round picks. And we talked about this a little bit earlier because Jason Caffey was like kind of one of the holdovers after the Bulls dynasty, but he did leave and then came back and was there until the early 2000s. And I thought that the Jerry Krause quote, or actually I guess Dennis Rodman's response to Jerry Krause after he explained that one of the reasons why he traded Caffey was that he allowed that Caffey being there allowed Dennis Rodman to flip out occasionally, knowing that he had a quality backup who could fill his position too, while Rodman served a suspension. So apparently getting rid of that was part of the motivation there. And Rodman's quote for Jerry Krause was very funny.
It's incredible. Yeah. So it's Rodman being quoted after the Bulls beat the Wizards 94-88. He says, I think Jerry Krause would keep his mouth shut. He is always telling me to keep my mouth closed. When I say something stupid, he should keep his mouth closed. I'm going to continue to be the same old Dennis. That is a bad strategy. They should keep the team together no matter what. So Dennis says, fuck off, I'm not changing. So I'm going to keep being me. I don't care who's backing me up. I'm going to get thrown out of the game sometimes. So yeah, that's... Oh, Dennis, yeah, this Bulls thing is... this isn't long for the world.
probably not. No. And then final trade, very minor, but the 76ers trading Terry Cummings to the Knicks for Ron Grandison and Herb Williams.
That's a lot of old men getting traded there. Right? Terry Cummings and Herb Williams.
And there were a few quotes about from officials that were upset about the fact that players had didn't dictate where they were traded to, basically refusing to report. Larry Miller, the Jazz owner, said to start having players say, I don't want this team or that team or this city or that city, I think is very serious. If it becomes the norm in the league, it could create chaos. We sure can't just let them run amok, which is
funny thing. Believe it or not, a term, yes. An actual quote from 1998 and not, 1887.
Yeah. Right. We can't let them run amok.
Or 1778. But yeah,
the implications there are not ideal.
Not great. No. We can't have them revolting, these people of, Yeah. So yeah, that's not great in 1998.
Yes. But. So, So the Raptors are, we talked about their struggles already, and they had the earlier stuff in the season with Isaiah Thomas leaving. So they do a lot of house cleaning. First of all, the most important thing is they change ownership. The Maple Leafs Limited buys the Raptors Union Station and the soon-to-be-built Air Canada Center for $350 million. It kind of allows that to kind of go forward and secures the future of the Raptors, who were kind of struggling financially. Daryl Walker resigns as the head coach. And then Butch Carter is his replacement. I got them mixed up during the last show. And then Damon Stoudamire, after the trade, he blamed the former owner Alan Slate for the club's disintegration, says that he suspect that he kept the entire team in the dark about its ownership intentions. And his quote was, he flat out lied, saying he would do what he was going to do, whatever it took to make the team a winner. And Chauncey Billups, when he came to the Raptors, actually did play okay. He had a number of assists, but he definitely he actually played 20. He had a season high 27 points in one of his first game with the Raptors. And Carter said, Chauncey's going to drive me crazy, but he's also going to get a lot of love from me. There are some things Chauncey still has to learn. We've already made some progress with him. And of course, it's interesting that Billups and McGrady, both very young in their career, were teammates, and they could have put Billups, McGrady, and Carter together on a team when Carter comes on the team next year. So, but they would lose Billups. We'll get into mm-hmm. that when that happens. But that's interesting stuff.
Yeah, you're starting to see the build of what we'd see in the future of the Raptors team kind of coming together a little bit, and you're starting to see that where you had your previous Raptors era, which was really confusing and nobody really knew, and there was always different. You had your Marcus Camby era briefly, and then you had the Stoudamire briefly, and it seems like there's some stability kind of coming there a little bit. So that's cool to see that they're kind of in some ways getting things together and sort of building for a longer, more sustained run. And of course, that would come down the line a little bit. But yeah, it's nice to see that some stability to that franchise, because both of the Canadian franchises were really just like in a complete disaster at this point and really a total mess. So it's good to see that, at least one of them is seems like they're kind of getting on the right path, even though it would take a few years until that would totally come to fruition.
Right. Yeah. Honestly, a core. I mean, they ended up trading for some veterans and had some pretty good seasons in, the early 2000s. But, if they had stuck with, Billups, Camby, McGrady, and Carter, like what that would have looked like. That could have been like a really super team. And maybe that just wasn't going to work out because of the relationships there and all that. But that really would have been something to, the potential of that is really mm-hmm. interesting.
But getting rid of Isaiah is always a good option. So
that was good. Yeah.
More times than not puts you on the right path. That was a good move.
Fair point. Toronto. Yeah. I mean, what they had obviously with Carter was special. So, the other way is interesting too. Mm-hmm. Yes, and the we already talked about how the Nuggets were pretty blatantly tanking and hoarding free agent space.
Talking about tanking, started this year, right? It started with the 76ers. What are you talking about tanking? What do you mean? Yes. Why are you even using that word? There's no such thing until the Sixers a few years ago, and then this year, there's a lot of teams doing it. But yeah, no, that's when it started, right. Jason. You're wrong. And we did that. Show about the history of tanking, and it goes back until the earliest days of the leagues. But no, you're lying. There's no way that they were tanking. They were trying to win, Jason.
I'm sorry. Forgive me.
They just so happened to be 4-42. Like, it just kind of happens.
Yeah. Yes, the team played so poorly that they felt some pressure to actually not super tank. So their GM, Alan Bristow, was fired. He was the same one who got into the fight as a Hornets GM. And we talked about him a little bit already. But he was fired, and he had been hired just a year before to replace Bernie Bickerstaff. Basically, he designed a rebuilding pro. They went in intentionally rebuilding. Well, we won't call it tanking, but dismissed Dick Motta as coach and replaced him with Bill Hanslick, who was a longtime friend, had been a Nuggets player as well. Got rid of some long term contracts in a series of trade to clear some salary cap room, but the current roster was very short of talent. Had the issue where he was unable to renegotiate an extension for Antonio McDyess, so he traded him to the Suns for 3 future first round picks and 2 future second round picks, which kind of makes sense, honestly. If you couldn't do that, that's a pretty good. That didn't really work out for them, but that was a kind of a good return at the time. Mike D'Antoni replaced him as was the interim GM, so getting some personnel power there. He had been the team's director of player personnel, so And they were looking at the Nuggets were looking at Lakers GM Mitch Kupchak and also former Nuggets coach Dan Issel as possible replacements. So, and there's a post from Denver Sips a few years ago looking at Bristow and honestly put a lot of the blame on what happened on Bickerstaff, that the mess was so bad there that really Bristow didn't really have there was no chance of being able to turn it around that quickly, and that really looking at also there was a lot of uncertainty with the Nuggets ownership situation, so that really wasn't going to work out there. But I thought it was notable that I think this was before Bristow was fired, or maybe slightly after, but a lot of the notable 98 free agents, including Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, Tom Gugliotta, and Tony McDyess, all scoffed at the notion with signing with the Nuggets. In fact, Rodman said that playing the Nuggets is like playing a high school team, and he said, "I'd never come here." And but then Hanslick, the coach, said that, well, you know, we're going to have 16 some million under the salary cap, so, you know, dollar signs are probably the biggest factor in getting guys. So it's like, well, you know, no one wants to play here, but we'll have so much money that someone will have to play here, basically what he's saying, which, again, usually they don't quite come out and say that. We know that's true, but no one actually comes out and actually says that.
Yeah, that's it's a little presumptuous. No, it didn't. It was definitely, yeah. But yeah, the things are getting real bad in Denver, man, and it kind of stinks, because that was a franchise that had a lot of fun history, a lot of fun, and it would be, I mean, of course, this would set the stage for a long time until the team even got anywhere near, you know, competitive again, and yeah, it'd be obviously a ton of moves that would go on in the next few years. But yeah, this year, but I guess when you look at it overall, like, they had sort of been treading along and kind of treading water for a few years, so this, I dare I say, tank or whatever, got them, I guess, on the right path, but it was really brutal as it was doing it. Like, it was real bad. And this year particularly stands out. And yeah, like you said, unfortunately, you can't really sell that to free agents. Like, hey, want to come here? And it's like, not really. No, because you guys are really, really bad. Like, I can get money from a team that's not horribly terrible. So
yes. Well, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when they actually do try to pursue a free agent and how things go there. But yes, it's some fun things there. Yes. So the Nuggets by March 10th, which is roughly the end of our period of discussion here, were 5-58. They were on a 16-game losing streak, and that ties them with the worst start ever with the 73 Sixers, the team that went 9-73. So it will get slightly better from there, but we'll get into that next time.
Absolutely, yeah.
So a few other interesting notes. Dennis Rodman, ABC movie, Bad As I Want to Be, the Dennis Rodman story, aired. It aired going up against the second half of the All-Star game.
Yeah, I don't know who decided that was a good idea. Like, what's our target demographic? Yeah. NBA fans. All right, cool. Let's throw this up at the same time. I don't know. I guess ABC wanted to show and see if they could compete with the All-Star game. I don't know. Yeah, that's really...
Well, yeah, I guess maybe, like, if the All-Star game is a blowout and you know people who are NBA fans are watching TV anyway, they know it's on, they might flip to it at certain points.
I guess it's an interesting strategy. Yeah, I don't know.
I guess I kind of get that, but yeah, it's a little bit odd. Yes, it was not reviewed well, surprisingly enough. So David Stern and some NBA players were on Meet the Press. A lot of this had to do with, like, the labor situation coming up, of course, the Sprewell stuff. And Stern was repeatedly asked about the league's policy toward including marijuana among the banned substances list in the next CBA, which was a big issue of contention, of course, you know, scary black dude smoking marijuana, you know, of course, the whole thing there. Kobe Bryant, marijuana is illegal. Therefore, by means of the law, it should be illegal in the NBA as well. Which is an interesting thing for Kobe to say. A lot of contention there. And Stern actually, to a degree, kind of defended the players. There were something was written where Karl Malone said that up to 70% of players in the league use marijuana. And then Stern kind of went back on that. It's like, no, actually, he didn't say that. And, this is more about reputation than it is about, like, what actually is going on type of stuff.
Right. So, yeah. And it's a really contentious argument too. Cause like it's Bob Costas kind of prodding at David Stern, and David Stern's not really a man who enjoys when people do that to him. So it did not go well. And Costas is a guy who can sort of sense when things are going that way and really kind of drive it in too. So yeah, it did not work out very well for any party involved.
No. Anthony Mason was arrested for with the Hornets was arrested for informally charged with statutory rape, sexual abuse, and endangering minors. This I think was involved him and some underage girls that were in his car and sort of thing. Also, the owner of the Hornets, George Sinn, was there was a lawsuit renewing accusations that she was attacked and sexually abused by Sinn last fall. At the time, prosecutors said there was not enough evidence to bring charges against him. He would sue her for called it a $5 million extortion plot. This would all come to a head in the next year, but this was sort of a step in what would become a big scandal for him. And then Mike Mathis, who had been a referee since the since 11 NBA Finals and two All-Star games, he pleaded guilty to a felony tax charge and resigned from the leagues. This was kind of the end of a big scandal involving NBA referees who understated their income by trading first-class airline tickets for cheaper coach tickets and pocketing the difference, which seems like, I don't know, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but I guess if you're the IRS, it is. So,
yeah, I guess I would probably do that.
Yes.
Other than the IRS implications, I'm good with coach. Like, that's fine. I'll take the extra money.
Also
with the people. I don't mind sitting with the people. So.
The NBA and the Hard Rock Cafe had a restaurant venture that saw the NBA license its name and logos to 29 teams for Hard Rock. The TV ratings were up on NBC, although they were down on TNT at the time. Notable there. We'll see how things go in 99 without Michael Jordan. And speaking of Jordan, he is the...
I'm sure great. Yeah. I'm guessing great is my prediction right now. So.
And he earned $33 million that season, pushing the Bulls payroll to a league high of $61 million, which was more than twice the salary cap at the time was $26 million. Actually,
yeah, those cheap Bulls again, man. I tell you, they're one of the cheapest franchises in the world. They just wouldn't pay their players. Those cheap
Bulls.
Well,
if you're Scottie Pippen, they wouldn't pay you, but, you know. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Well, yeah, because all the money was going to
James. Exactly. Yes. So interesting things there. Bill Fitch passed Red Auerbach to become the second winningest coach in NBA history behind Lenny Wilkins. He was coaching the Clippers, who did not have a lot of wins. So every win, you know, the wins did not come quickly that year, but he did eventually pass by. And interestingly enough, Gary Payton led a boycott of NBC after studio analyst Peter Vesey made detrimental comments about Peyton's practice habits and inferred that he was a bad influence on teammate Vin Baker. So this was according to Glenn Nelson of the Seattle Times. Interesting things there.
Yeah, and Vesey's had a long history of that,
yeah,
and people not really enjoying him all that much, particularly players. He's definitely been very critical of players in the history. I know there's a long, long list of guys that are not big fans of Peter Vesey, but yeah, not surprising that he would pop up again here for something like that.
Yeah, so. And he had been a source of the rumors that popped up the year before with Sean Kemp in terms of you know, the idea that he had, you know, had an alcohol issue, or that, you know, kind of led to some of the rumors that ended up leading to a divide there. I'm not saying they necessarily caused them, but, you know, they but it felt as though, like, he you know, caused issues there, or at least exacerbated some of the issues there.
Is he the Joe Barely Cares guy, or is that someone else?
I believe Peter Vesey did say Joe Barely Cares. I believe that was his. So
okay,
yeah.
And I remember one time too. I think he did an interview with Karl Malone after they lost the
finals,
and Malone was like seconds away from just decking him
because
Vesey just keeps like prodding, and it's like maybe not right now, man. Like maybe let's, you know, tomorrow. Can you ask these questions?
Right. So Pat Riley was NBA Coach of the Month, became the fifth coach to win 900 games. The Heat actually went 14-1 during the month to really get very close to the number one seed. And Pat Riley also we talked a little bit about how there was some pushback on the idea of players being able to you know, decide where they land. And his quote was, if the players push this game to the point where none of the reward is ever going to come back to the owner, then they will all get out of this and we will all be on a white sandy beach someday. And then he also said, one day, and I can't wait for the day, an owner is going to sue a player and his agent for damages for killing trades or not wanting to go somewhere else. One owner is going to win a lot of damages because that isn't right. So Pat Riley, definitely a cop. I think that's fairly clear right there.
Oh, Pat. Oh, yes. Pat Riley, what a jerk. All right.
So we're at the point of the monthly wrap up, and some interesting things going on in terms of the playoff picture.
Yeah, definitely some good stuff going on here. So let's look at it. So you got the Sonics. They have a 4-game lead for the number one seed in the West. The Lakers, or the Jazz, Lakers, Spurs, and Suns are all neck and neck for number two seed. So you got a nice little battle there at the top of the West. The Blazers, 33 wins. The Wolves, 31. And the Rockets, 28. I'll round out the Western Conference. As we mentioned a few months prior, the bottom half of the Western Conference is a disaster. Because, like, you have a bunch of teams in play for the, you know, the first eight seeds and where they're going to be and where they're going to kind of seed and whatnot. And then you have the Nuggets at 5-53. The not taking Nuggets at 5-53. The Mavericks, who are definitely trying to win at 11-46. The Clippers at 12-45. The Golden State Warriors at 12-45. The Vancouver Grizzlies at 14-43. And the Sacramento Kings are your lone, like, kind of just team that's kind of in the middle there. They're at 24-35. They're bad, but they're not, like, as horrible as the other ones, and they're not obviously a playoff team. So nothing too much there. And as far as the East, you got the Bulls. They have a 2-game lead over the Pacers and the Heat for number one seed in the East. The Hornets, with 34 wins, are 8 games back, and in a cluster with the Hawks, who have 34 wins, the Knicks at 33, and the Nets at 33. And the Cavs, 8 seed right now with 31 wins, but you also have the Magic, Wizards, Bucks, and Celtics. They're about 2-3 games behind. And yeah, as a juxtaposition, the Eastern Conference, you have one real bad team, the Toronto Raptors, at 13-43. Philadelphia 76ers aren't great at 19-37. And then for that point on, it's pretty much everybody else is kind of still in play. Like, the Pistons are 26-31, as we mentioned, definitely still kind of in play. Boston Celtics at 28-30, still in play to make the playoffs. So you got a real big run up in the East and a lot of teams, you know, with potentials to make runs, whereas the West is pretty well locked in with the first eight. It's just a matter of where is everyone going to kind of land when it's all said and done.
Yeah. The Kings are 4.5 games behind the Rockets for the eighth seed. So they're not officially out of it, but they're, you know, it's highly unlikely, of course, that they're going to be able to make it there. And then everyone else beyond them, you know, the Grizzlies are 10 games behind the Kings, you know, so that's, or nine games, I guess. So that's, yeah, obviously a huge difference. So we talked a little bit about that disparity already, and it's only going to get worse as the rest of the season goes along. We'll have to see if, I'm sure maybe it has, but we'll have to see if there's any sort of similar disparity that's ever happened in NBA history between the haves and have-nots in a conference, because I would guess that is probably exceedingly rare. But
yeah, and it's just interesting to see the East too, because there's 13 teams like a legit chance to make the playoffs, right, which is nuts at this point. Like, we're in February now. I mean, that's like right now, go to the league and look at the standings. Like, there's not 13 teams that really, I mean, that's sort of, see that many be in the play in the East and like all have legit chances at making it is pretty interesting. But yeah, then the West is like, here's eight and then maybe nine with the Kings.
You know? Exactly. Yes. So, all right. Well, thanks everyone for checking us out. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Over and Back NBA and Facebook as well. And you can follow this series, NBA 20 years ago, with many of the events and top highlights and GIFs from going on during the 98 season and beyond as we continue the series. So I hope everyone's enjoying it. You can find us, of course, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can also find us at The Step Back at fansided.com. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.